Oh, wow. It's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Oh, wow.
Who did that voiceover?
It's... Amelia.
Oh, okay.
She's one of our, she's our creative director.
Very creative.
Yes,
okay.
She probably wrote the ad as well. Okay. Harvard chemistry lecturer has been arrested over funding issues.
Oh, not even a lecturer. My goodness.
Okay, sorry.
He's the head.
Let's read that. He's more than that.
Oh, okay. Yes, indeed. He's the head of chemistry and chemical biology at Harvard.
Okay, big deal.
Oh, very big deal. Okay. So, Harvard, as I'm sure you know, is... one of the top two sort of universities in the world, pretty much, on all the rankings. It seems
prestigious
to come up,
school.
You know.
Yeah.
You've got your Harvard, you've got your Oxford, Cambridge, MIT, so they're sort of the top ones.
Mm-hmm.
Extraordinarily prestigious. And so they have the absolute top academics on the planet there, you know. Absolutely no doubt about that. So it was a little bit of a surprise to wake up, I guess, was it... about the 28th of January, and find out on Twitter, at least, that the head of the chemistry and chemical biology department at Harvard had been arrested.
And this doesn't happen often.
This
for academics,
you'd hope not. Like no. This is just pretty much unprecedented, really. And so he was arrested by the FBI, and he posted his $1 million bail a couple of days later.
Whoa.
So
he had $1 million.
Oh, yes, indeed. Yeah, $1 million bail. And he had to surrender his and his wife's passports in case they went away. So you'll all be thinking, right, why did he get arrested? So he had connections with China. And his big mistake, seemingly, was that he did not say anything about these connections with China to Harvard. So the story goes, and these are the details that have come out, obviously, before his trial, and Lord knows when his trial is going to be, but he's on sort of indefinite leave from Harvard at the moment, on full pay, apparently.
Wow.
which is kind of ironic when you hear what's going to come. So China, as I'm sure you know, does remarkable science, okay? Mm-hmm. So they are throwing money at science like there's no tomorrow. You know, they're doing incredible stuff. And you look at China, say, gosh, I don't know, 40 years ago probably, they really weren't doing much at all. So, you know, what they've done over the intervening 40 years is quite remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ways that they've done this is that they've sort of targeted... Chinese expats,
okay,
in so-called first world countries, so in, you know, in the States and in England and stuff like that, and they've tried to
just
get them back to
other countries,
and they've tried to get them back to China, basically. So these folk have been overseas, they've got all the experience, and then they bring them back to China, okay. And so this is called the Thousand Talents Program.
Mm-hmm.
And so as time has gone on and the universities in China have got more and more and more prestigious, obviously they're targeting more and more prestigious people.
Mm-hmm.
So this head of chemistry at Harvard, so his name's Charles Lieber, and he's a stellar chemist. He won a thing called the Wolf Prize in 2012, and winning the Wolf Prize is often a precursor to winning the Nobel Prize.
Wow.
So, you know, he's right up there. And he's into nanoscience, nanotechnology, big money in that. It's a very, 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 very sexy area. And so somewhere between 2012 and 2017, he was approached by the Wuhan Institute of Technology. Kind of ironic, Wuhan sort of crops up in this with the whole coronavirus thing going on there at the moment. And apparently what they did was they offered him a salary of $50,000 a month.
Whoa.
And living expenses of $150,000 a year to basically go and work for them. He also got a $1.5 million startup fee to set up a lab at the Wuhan Institute of Technology, with the proviso apparently that he had to work there for 9 months of the year.
What?
Yeah,
I know. How does that work?
Well,
how is he still employed at Harvard?
Well, that's the thing. He didn't tell anybody at Harvard. Nobody knew about this. Okay, nobody knew. And so this money that he was getting was in addition to the
salary from Harvard.
To the salary from Harvard, plus the $15 million in grant money he'd got since 2008 from the National Institutes of Health.
Wow.
And the proviso of that is that you have to declare any interest with any other countries to get sort of this federal funding in the States. And he didn't do that. Somehow this caught up with them.
Somehow though. Is he in the country for 9 months of the year?
I don't know, and I'm sure this will all come out at
in the trial. Still not sure. We don't know how he managed this yet.
Utterly, utterly bizarre. So, no, you're right. We don't know how he managed this yet.
It's pretty impressive, I have to say.
Oh, boy. But so this was part of this 1,000 talents thing. So and this will be funded by the Chinese government, at least in part anyway. And so he's been awfully, awfully caught out on this.
Mm. And it's another one of those stories about declaring the funding, right? In terms of declaring what this agenda might be or could be, or if there are other purposes at play for the type of research that you're doing. Is that
I think the problem that one of the problems that the Feds had with this is that this nanotechnology is a very, very sexy area, and there's probably sort of defense implications and stuff in there, and so he was obviously setting himself up as maybe a blackmail target by the Chinese or whatever, you know.
So would he have just been taking the same research he was doing in Harvard over to China?
Presumably.
So it had become a national security, in quotation marks, a national security issue.
I think that's the way that they're going to play it, very probably. He was also, under the terms of his agreement with Wuhan, he had to take some Chinese nationals into his lab for a couple of months a year. And again, that's probably a security sort of problem and stuff. And wow. So, so the current situation is he's out on bail and we don't know what's going to happen here.
Okay.
But it's quite unprecedented.
It's a fascinating case to follow, I suppose.
So, yeah.
Okay. Now, this is not very similar at all, but a quick retraction of a faulty paper.
Yes. So, again, I guess going back to Wuhan and the whole coronavirus thing, and Marcus talked about coronavirus on the show last week. But this raised an interesting point, I guess. Now, the whole coronavirus thing is an extraordinarily rapidly changing story, okay? And if you listen to the media, you know, they are saying basically different things, you know, every day as this goes on, you know, we're finding out new things about the whole virus and how it's transmitted and how it's not transmitted, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I guess the latest thing, if you have a look on Twitter today, there's from the official Chinese government feed, they're going around Wuhan just basically spraying the streets with God knows what.
As in to kill any germs?
Presumably. Well, supposedly anyway. So, you know, there's these impressive sort of clouds of white stuff, God knows what it is, but, you know, they're certainly being seen to be doing something. So, but in the very, very early days of this, there was a paper appeared on a thing called a preprint server. Okay.
What's that?
Right. So, I was hoping you'd ask that. Okay. Now, the usual way that science is communicated is by publication in journals, okay? And if you submit a paper to a journal, what normally happens is that it goes to the editor of that journal. The editor then, using their knowledge, comes up with a couple or three possible reviewers for that paper, okay, who are experts in that field. They send them off to them. They come back with their responses, opinions, whatever, is whether it's good enough to be published or not, and then the editor acts on those opinions. Now, obviously, that's a time-consuming situation, so that's going to take at the very least, probably at least, you know, 4 weeks, probably. Mm-hmm. Four weeks, absolute minimum. Now, there are these things that have sprung up called preprint servers, where people are taking their manuscripts and they're just putting them on these servers so that everyone can see them.
Before it even goes through that process.
Right, before it goes through that process. And what this then, supposedly what this then gives everybody a chance to do is to actually read it themselves. So lots and lots and lots of people can go to these preprint servers and then read the papers, and they can offer their opinions on them. Okay, so this is sort of it's a different form of what you would call peer review, which is what happens with the journals.
But any person can go on there.
Yes, absolutely. And Well, I guess the flip side of that is that anybody can put...
That's what I mean. It's not necessarily peer review.
Well, no. Well, anybody can put a paper on there. That's the flip side of that. Yes,
okay.
Anyone can read them, but anybody can basically post pretty much anything. So there was a group in India who came up with a paper that had the flashy title of Uncanny Similarity of Unique Inserts in the 2019 nCoV Spike Protein to HIV, GP120 and GAG.
Okay.
Right, so there you go.
Yes.
So basically what they were saying, what this paper was essentially saying, is that the coronavirus appears very, very similar to the HIV virus, and so their implication was that it had been manufactured by humans.
Ah.
Ah, okay.
Big problem?
Big call to make that.
Okay, yeah.
Big call. And thankfully, it was taken down pretty much sort of the next day or the day after the next day, because basically people said, no, this isn't
right. It's not possible to have even studied it, would it be?
The Australians, I think, have sort of replicated it, et cetera, et cetera. But
we're
right. I mean, they haven't
had
the time
to. A few weeks ago.
Exactly.
They wouldn't have even had access to the actual virus. Okay.
So, now, really, if this had got out into the mainstream media, and I do sort of recall sort of a couple of places reporting it, you know, this is your big conspiracy theory, isn't it? Oh, the Chinese government is manufacturing, you know, that's basically the implication there. So, as I say, thankfully it was taken down, but it just raises a question of how do we go about communicating science in such a rapidly unfolding situation as this, because things are changing literally every day. And so the whole peer review process is much too slow to be able to cope with this, really. So the question then becomes, how do we do this? You know, who are we relying on? And basically, as I think anyway, in a situation like this, you are just going for the absolute top world experts on viruses, basically. And you're going to listen to them because they know the most, you know. And you've just got to take them on trust, I think, really. And, you know,
until the next thing comes out, I suppose.
Until you get the time to be able to study this thing in detail. Mm. And that's what it needs. It needs time. But time might be one thing that we don't have in this particular case.
Right now.
So there's a bit of a quandary for everybody to have a wee think about, I guess. So, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you, Alan. Let's do this one, last one, a little quickly.
We will do it very quickly.
We're talking cancer and what we don't know.
Indeed. So there's a thing called the Pan Cancer Analysis of Whole Genomes Project, and that is a multinational project involving lots of labs around Europe, the UK, North America, and Australia. And basically, the question is, when do we get cancer? If we get cancer, when do we get it? You know, are there any markers there that sort of might be useful for us in diagnosing cancer a lot sooner than we currently do? Because sadly, oftentimes, if you're diagnosed with cancer, it's almost too late, you know, if it gets to that particular stage. So cancer is essentially a disease, a genetic disease. So, you know, it's basically a mutation of your DNA, pretty much, you know. And so what these folk are looking at is they're looking at mutations in DNA and seeing if any of those can point to a very, very early diagnosis of cancer. So are these mutations sort of common to cells that go on and then become cancerous? And what they found was that in about 9 genes, so roughly around about 50% of the bad mutations, if you would, the ones that go on and cause cancer, can be found in 9 genes. So only 9.
Right.
So basically what they're saying is, right, in the future, we may well be able to target those 9 genes. We might be able to actually look at those in, you know, supposedly healthy people and see if that mutation exists. And then, again, further down the track, we might then be able to specifically target those cells that have those mutations and kill them, et cetera, et cetera. So we're actually talking in terms of years, if not decades, prior to the diagnosis of cancer here, which this is, you know, that's pretty cool.
This is major. And is, correct me if I'm wrong, is this something that they do in terms of cervical smears? Because this is where they look for abnormal sort of cells, yes, in a way, which would essentially be because of a mutation, is that correct?
Yeah, except they'll be doing it sort of a lot sooner, because now they know exactly what to look for. So that all they've got to look for are these specific genes, rather than having to do an enormous screening.
Okay.
You know, they can basically narrow things down, and that makes life a lot easier.
Wow.
Okay,
incredible.
This could be big, and you know, this is truly big science. As I said, you know, it's a multinational thing. Lots of labs around the world, lots of samples, and you know, this is what collaborative science is all about. And you know, this hopefully will turn out to be a big success.
Brilliant.
And, yeah, I think it's just nice science.
It's nice. Thank you, Alan. Thanks for coming in, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Always a pleasure.
Mind blown. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.